Call this meeting to order of the Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development Policy Committee. And we don't have a quorum yet, but Rob, you sit over here. I think we just got a quorum. Like to move the minutes. We have the last minutes of, when was that? March 19th of 2015. Has anybody read those minutes lately?
I did.
Good. Do you want to approve this?
Like to move the minutes.
Okay. Minutes been read and approved. All in favor of that. Representative Sundin approved the minutes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Passed. So now we have some people to introduce. We have some pages. Sean and Matt McGinnis. Where are they? I want to raise your hands wherever you are. There he is. Welcome to our committee. And we have a new committee member, and very pleased to have you here, Rob Eklund. And you're smaller than Dill, but you're about the same build and stuff. We will miss him, but we're awful happy to have you, and I hope you enjoy this committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, since we have the author of the first bill here, I'm sure she would like to sit at the testifying table and move her bill. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move, it's House File 2798, recommended to pass to the Jobs Committee. Jobs Energy
Very well.
Committee. Great.
I'd like to remind everybody that this is not a finance committee. You can certainly move a bill here and talk about the bill, but we cannot amend financing in any bill in this committee. It has to go to the Jobs Finance Committee or some other finance committee before we can do that. So with that announcement, I think it will treat everybody fairly. And we'd love to hear more about your bill now.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you, committee. We are bringing the pipeline bill, the dual training bill, before you again to make some changes, because as the bill was rolled out, as you will hear from the testifiers today, we had some great things and we had some things that we could make a little bit better. And so the bill that is in front of you deals with several changes. Most of them are fairly minor. Some of them have a little bit more substantive change that would really help this program to roll out a little bit better. And just to remind you, so the pipeline bill it's a dual education opportunity. It's a public and private partnership. And it really, a lot of the emphasis has been in Greater Minnesota, which you will hear. What this bill does is it provides a little bit more emphasis on new hires instead of incumbent workers, because we found as the program rolled out, even though the goal was to provide new workers, the focus was very heavily on the incumbent worker side. And so we've made some changes so that the focus really is on some new hires, and specifically those with high school equivalent education. It also adds a little bit more flexibility for employers moving forward and how to pay for the program, because as you recall, probably that those businesses that were $25 million in gross revenue and above had a participation that they had to pay 25% of the costs. We also are defining the cost a little bit better. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers because they're very excited to testify today. And the first one we have is actually from UMC, which is a manufacturing facility in my district. And they also received one of the grants.
Welcome to our committee. Please give your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Jackie Dukowitz, and I'm the Director of HR and Development at UMC in Monticello. So UMC is a precision manufacturer of complex metal parts that are made in that heavily regulated environment of medical, med device, and aerospace industries. Machinists are the bread and butter of our company. Currently, over our three shifts, we employ more than 65 highly paid machinists who average approximately $25 an hour, or with an annual salary in their overtime, about $70,000 or more a year. UMC is a healthy and thriving company, and we could immediately bring on an additional 20 skilled machinists if they were available to hire. As I mentioned, because of our regulated and complex environment at UMC, we do require that two-year technical degree or a lot of commensurate experience in order to operate our $500,000 or more machines within the building. So there are several ways in which programs like this pipeline project would benefit a company like ours, and I'm excited to see the progress and the evolution of the language within the grant. Initially, UMC thought we could leverage the project in one of three ways to help train our workforce, including, first, elevating our current competencies and skills of the current machinists that we have on board. Secondly, to maybe enhance our long-standing youth and technical apprenticeship programs. And then third, to offer that career path opportunity for entry-level workers to advance into that machinist role by obtaining their two-year degree. Due to a few of the early parameters and some resource constraints within the process, I am the only available resource internally at UMC to help with this process. We chose to focus on that third option with entry-level employees getting that two-year degree as machinists. So once we narrowed, we had to quickly name our education partner, complete the application, communicate to our internal employees to try to get people on board with this, and then go through the projected costs and other pieces to structure the whole endeavor. I believe in our case, this was a total of 3 weeks from the time we were made aware to the time that we had to submit the grant application. As you can imagine, it was a little hectic. So I'd like to express, of course, my appreciation to our education partner, which was the St. Cloud Technical and Community College, because we already had an established relationship with them. That helped us expedite the process with the school quickly. However, navigating our own internal challenges proved to be very complex as well. Agreeing to participate as an employee required a leap of faith. The grant, as it was previously written, we could not guarantee that funding would be available or approved beyond that first calendar year towards a full degree completion. That made several employees pretty nervous about getting in the process. They opted out. These employees who we targeted were also pretty intimidated by the application process across the board. They had to go and apply for a technical degree program, and most of them have no education beyond that high school degree. They definitely also felt the pressure of the time constraints from when we needed to have their decision and commitment as well. So out of those potentially 100 employees that we thought we could get involved and benefit from the project, UMC ended with one candidate who went through the entire process. I share this experience because UMC does want to continue to partner with the state on developing the skills in advanced manufacturing, but the reality of my experience was that the coordination of the efforts was much greater than we anticipated, and the ability to broadly impact skills was much narrower. Overall, it was challenging to align the resources, and the timing was challenged with our limited resources. I imagine employers with less of that staff and experience in the area than UMC has would feel this even more. I am encouraged greatly that you're soliciting feedback from employers like us with a focus on flexibility within the language, the continued evolution on the support resources available, and altogether, we think this can help manufacturing flourish. As an employer, I too am doing my part working on some of our internal resource constraints. We need to come to the table and create an internal training resource that can help coordinate these kind of efforts. We want to take full advantage and need to go that route as well. We're in this thing together to improve the economic status of our employees and the state of Minnesota. This isn't just about coordination of grants and funding. It's about enhancing manufacturing's economic impact across the state of Minnesota.
Okay. I got one question for you before you leave, Jackie. What good do you think this bill is going to do for you?
Well, the funding and the grant opportunity does take a little of the burden off of UMC from the funding perspective. The dollars help a lot, you know, limited training budgets. We think that this could help those employees who are nervous to start feel the support of not only the organization, but the extra funding really gives them that extra step to go forward with it. We had great engagement from our employees. It was just they were a little nervous because they do have to be invested on their end. A two-year degree program for someone with a high school diploma and a full-time job is a huge commitment. So that's another thing that as an employer, I'd like to see this evolve for us to do some internal on-site training, not necessarily have to engage at the full, you know, send you off to the technical college to get your degree and disappear for 2 years and then come back with this. We want to integrate more and be able to facilitate some of that on-site, but we need to ramp up our resources to do that too.
Okay, thank you. Good answer. Representative Mahoney.
To the testifier, you spoke to the complications of the application. And in current law, it states the commissioner must, to the extent possible, make the application as short form, the application form is short and simple to complete as is reasonably possible. How many pages were they asking you or the applicant to fill out? And I don't need an exact number, but I mean, was it 10, 25, 125?
No, maybe 6 or so. It wasn't 10 to 25. It was not cumbersome. Again, additionally, that employee had to go apply with the college and go through the entire admissions process and go through that as well. So there was some on my end completing the application, understanding how much. As an example, I had to go to the technical college's website, figure out how much the tuition cost was, kind of compile all of that, pull it together, times how many students I was going to have, and then I had to get their commitment. So it was kind of timing. It was kind of the application, and then it was, you know, I didn't have that information readily at my fingertips beginning the process.
Mr. Chair,
Representative?
A couple of things here, and then I'll be done. I liked what you said about having to increase your capacity at your place of business. Where this all comes out of is a German trip, which I was on, and there was the larger companies had small areas, maybe the size of all this, the tables here, a training facility in their facility, and their trainees went and worked in that area with their mentor at the shop. But then the companies came together and created their own high school, not high school, but a training facility with multiple different, and this was actually in the machining end of the world. They had probably 5,000 or 6,000 square feet filled with machines. And so that was how it gets done over there. We've tried to do it on the cheap.
Yep.
I get that. But I will never forget the line that came out of, I won't mention who it was, but because in Germany it's a federal state manufacturer and union partnership. I really like the statement from one of the people that was more concerned about manufacturing that said, if this has anything to do with unions, I won't do anything with it.
And we are a non-union facility at UMC. No, I'm familiar with some of the models that you're talking, and I've got a 250 square foot space of training that we just invested in over the last year. We're also focused on that multimedia too. We don't have to have the student in the classroom. We're looking at telepresence where the instructor is located remotely and our students are able to learn through that model, sometime in the lab, sometime via the internet, and then sometimes on site at our place. But again, this is the elevation or the evolution of the experience. Starting here, the competencies, this is a great way to align us. To capitalize on it, it does take a significant resource by both the employer, the employees, and then all of you in this room as well.
Well, just so you know, the unions pay for all of our own training by ourselves, without state help. Not on the taxpayer dime. Just so everyone understood.
Get a plug in where we can, we? Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment to the testifier, and then probably a question for the author. I like the intent of the bill, you know, and I plan on supporting this. Just to let you know, I'm a head trustee over a financial institution that oversees a training center of 10,000 square feet up here in Little Canada. I'd like to invite the committee up for a visit sometime to see what the partnerships between unions and employers can actually accomplish. And this is just another step in the training, and I do appreciate the bill. I have one question on 3.23. This goes to if an employer demonstrates that it is not able to pay for the training in advance.
Not
go ahead.
No, I was just talking to someone else. Sorry.
Okay. Forgive me for interrupting. Are you done?
I'm done.
Okay. If an employer demonstrates it's not able to pay for the training in advance, the commissioner shall make grant payments directly to the training institution or program. Sometimes students wash out. If you pay in advance, is there a way to claw back that grant money included in here? I didn't see it.
So,
either one. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Sundin. I'm actually going to have the department come up. So we've got OHE coming and D coming that can speak to that change and if they have a process. Some of that's done through administratively, but I'm going to have them speak to that because they've been in the trenches working on this. So they're the next couple testifiers that are coming up. We can just hold that question.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying.
Thank you. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the two departments to come up now. And if I could, maybe we could grab another chair right around the corner.
Welcome to our committee. Keep your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jessica Luman. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. And I've had the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about this project in the past, but I'm really excited to give you an update in terms of where the Minnesota Pipeline project is, and then also talk about some of the tools that we're using, including the grant program, to really help advance the dual training and registered apprenticeship programs in Minnesota. So first, I'd like to thank Representative O'Neill and Representative Norton, who have been big champions of this project as we've moved forward in the last year and a half or so, as we have really started thinking differently about how employers invest in a Minnesota workforce in areas where we haven't traditionally have registered apprenticeship programs. So we've been looking at the dual training and registered apprenticeship models in new industries, including manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare, and advanced manufacturing. And really talking with employers, bringing groups of employers and educators and community-based organizations and labor together to talk about what could dual training and registered apprenticeship look like in these industries as we move forward. What kind of state support can we provide to these industries? What kind of state support can we provide to these students and these workers who are entering into these occupations? And how can we make it an employer-based training model that is really industry approach? And if you are getting a training at UMC, which was one of our great leaders, how does that also translate to one of our other industry manufacturing employers in Minnesota, the skills that you've learned and the occupations that you've developed while you've been with one? How does that really help the workers move forward in terms of building their career so that we're building the strongest workforce possible? So in the pipeline project, we are doing really using really three tools to move forward. One is our industry councils, and that is a group of over 350 different employer organizations, associations that have come together to talk about how what their high wage, high need, there we go, occupations are for their industry. Also, what dual training could look like. How do we bring this dual training model to their industry? And just to remind you, dual training is really three things. One, it's having a job in one of the occupations that we're talking about. Two, it's getting structured on-the-job training in a specific competencies for that occupation. And three, it's getting related technical instruction for that for those competencies in those occupations. So how do we make these kinds of programs move forward? And I think that the story that Jackie told us earlier is so indicative, because one of the things that we have really learned in this process is that this is, one, a new cultural change for a lot of employers to think about not hiring people who already have all of the skills or putting those in their job descriptions of that you already need this 2 years of technical education, but sort of stepping back and thinking about how do we invest in those workers in the first place and how do we help them get their 2 year technical education while they're being productive employees of our own organization. And what we found is that, frankly, the infrastructure needs to be developed. Employers who haven't traditionally used the registered apprenticeship model, unlike the construction trades, they don't have apprenticeship coordinators, and they don't have big training facilities, and they don't have even necessarily in some of these businesses a single person who's responsible for employee training. And so really one of our roles at the Department of Labor and Industry is helping them build and develop these new types of training programs within their own organizations. So we've talked with the industry councils about how to do this, what they need, what it looks like, how to move forward. One of the other things that we have done is we've done something called competency councils, which is we get a small group of subject matter experts together on one occupation, and that whole industry decides what it means to be trained in that occupation. And that, again, is a new model that we haven't been doing in Minnesota on an industry-wide and industry-validated basis. And then finally, we do dual training development. And that, again, is providing the technical support one-on-one with employers about how they could put a program like this together. And then we also help employers get hooked up with the dual training grants that are available so that they can help support the work that they're doing and the infrastructure that they're developing and the training that they're developing for their own programs. So I just want to tell you where we are today in terms of our results on this program. As I mentioned, we have more than 350 industry leaders engaged in the pipeline project. And again, employer-based training requires employers to be at the table to have the conversation. We've developed competency standards for 17 occupations. They're actually listed in your handout, if you have the handout. The 17 occupations we've already listed, plus we're in the process of developing 10 more right now. Having those competency councils, we continue to add more and more occupations as we have employers come forward saying, we need workers in this type of occupation. We have 40 employers that are actually ready to start dual training programs. And that's pretty huge because this is, like I said, a culture change, a new way of thinking, a new way of investing. Though that includes the 15 employers that have most recently received dual training grants. But we're also working with people who aren't applying for the grants but also want to set up registered apprenticeship programs or dual training programs in their organizations. We've created dual training kits, which helps employers deliver on the occupational competencies. We've also really worked on an outreach exposure and awareness plan to promote dual training. This is one of the things we heard over and over from our industry councils is how do we tell workers about what we're doing? How do we get the workers at UMC to also wrap their minds around this idea that while the employer is investing in them, they're also investing in their employer? And then also students and teachers and parents are all one of the areas that we need to continue, and the industry councils are continuing to address. One of the big recommendations that came out of the industry councils was the alignment with other workforce development programs. So we're continuing that work. And then what our partner at OHE is going to talk a little bit about is we are helping execute, we're providing technical support and ongoing support for the dual training grant program, which is, again, a really important tool to help employers start these kinds of workforce investment programs in their own organizations.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Norton.
Thank you very much, and it's really exciting to, I know all this, I'm like saying it with you as I listen to you, but it's very exciting to see how far we've come in really a very, very short time. So I want to thank you personally for the work that you've done, because you and some of the other folks over at your office and OHE, who came on kind of late in the game, they've just done a marvelous job, both indeed too. So thank you for that. Could you just address really quickly how the 15 grants that have been given out thus far, and we're going to, you know, make some improvements here today. How has that split urban, rural? Has it been primarily urban? As I know, Rochester, I know one employer down there applied, was involved with the industry councils, actually, and because of that involvement, applied for a grant. And so I think there's obviously outreach that will need to be done to broaden from the 350 businesses to more. But I wondered how it was breaking down urban, rural.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton. I'm going to hand over to Nicole to sort of talk about the mechanics of the grant, if that's okay, and I'll stick around if I can help.
Okay.
Nicole, will you give your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nicole Sorensen. I'm a research analyst at the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I am responsible for the dual training grant program. We're very excited to be partners with DLI on this new program and getting these grants off of the ground. So thanks for all your interest in this, and I look forward to answering your questions. So just a brief overview. We awarded the first round of grants in December of 2015, and we are working with those grantees to get their dual training programs off of the ground and get that money out to supporting student development and employee development. So you have a handout that kind of talks about the logistics of this. In the first round, the total amount of grants that was awarded was $490,000. That was about half of the appropriation for the first year. And so for how quickly we had to move with the creating an application and getting employers interested in this, and this being a brand new program, we were excited that we did have 15 applicants, and we were able to get some grants out the door quite quickly. So at the bottom of page one, you can see that there's a total grant amount, and that is going to support 125 student employees. On the top of page two, you can see the employers who were awarded in the first round of grants. Just so you know, all of the employers that applied were awarded grants. There was they weren't necessarily awarded in the total amounts that they asked for, because there was some confusion around the financial piece, but they were, all 15 of them were awarded a grant during the first round. So in terms of the split for the metro versus outstate, it was 7 grantees in the metro and 8 grantees outstate. The outstate grantees had smaller numbers of students in the program, so there was fewer dollars that went to outstate Minnesota, but more of the grantees were in outstate. To answer your question, Representative Norton. Yeah, so the next round of grants, we've put together a timeline. We expect to release an RFA for that in April, with applications due in May, and awarding those over the summer so that student employees could start training at a traditional post-secondary institution as soon as this fall. So we're really excited about that. We have the remaining $500,000 approximately from the first round, and then there's $2 million appropriated for fiscal year 17. And so we're looking to get applicants for quite a lot of resources to support training programs. So then we will consider adding a third round if there are dollars still available after the second round has been awarded. Some of the challenges that you've been hearing from our first testifier and our second have been around the fact that this is just a brand new thing, and we're working closely between DLI and OIG to help employers build dual training programs and get those off the ground, helping them partner with post-secondary institutions or other types of training programs and build these opportunities for their employees. Another challenge is around just figuring out what students are actually eligible for. So that was why some of the grant amounts weren't as much as they might have applied for, is because they didn't need a full $6,000 for each of the employees. And then there's also been some difficulties with the way the payment processing was required to be, and the contracting with both employers and training institutions. So I can talk more about some of the challenges we've encountered, but we think that the bill that's been introduced really helps us get money out to support this program much more efficiently. So we thank the author for these amendments. I'll take any questions.
Okay. Representative Sundin.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my role in real life, we do a lot of outreach work to Native bands, communities of color, and we do a pretty good job of diversifying our workforce so we can supply the diverse workforce that employers need, you know, for federal work and state work. When there's some goals to be met for diversity, I'm very proud of some of the unions that do a good job. I believe our district council is like 31% diversity. And others actually have exceeded that. But I'm just wondering, is there any component in here? I don't see anything that will be make this measure a little more inclusive to address diversity issues, so all of Minnesota is being served?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sundin, we all want to answer, so but Representative O'Neill was nice enough to let me go first. I think I have a couple of responses to that, which is, one, we really want to thank the building trades, particularly in the building trades registered apprenticeship programs, for stepping up and really thinking about this, being intentional about and being more and more inclusive in their registered apprenticeship programs, because we absolutely have seen greater opportunity, significantly greater opportunity in for women and minorities both in registered apprenticeship programs over the last 5 years, and that's because of the leadership that the building trades have really shown. And we are up to almost 31% of registered apprentices overall are now minorities, which is, we were at about low 17% a few years ago. So that's the first thing, is absolutely that we want to thank the employers and the unions for stepping up in doing that. The second thing that's important to keep in mind is that one of the things about registered apprenticeship. And one of the reasons that registered apprenticeship exists by the U.S. Department of Labor and at the Department of Labor and Industry is to provide more opportunity to women minorities. It's got a very large component of increasing diverse participation in skilled trades where trades and occupations where there may not have been large participation in women and minorities. The third thing I want to share with you is something from the industry councils, which was that was one of the things we heard over and over at all of the industry councils, whether it be IT or manufacturing or healthcare, and even agriculture, which was we know that the future, employers know that the future workforce is going to be more diverse. How do we help remove some of the barriers in the workforce development and workforce investment world? So, and this is one of the ways that people see as a tool is that if we're helping to do this employment-based training, we're going to be able to diversify the workforce, the skilled workforce, more quickly.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Sundin. And I just want to just reemphasize the fact that this is, again, a huge way to remove the barrier, which is a financial barrier. Organically, this is actually happening and will continue to happen. And the reason I'm bringing this bill is to make it easier, not harder, for businesses and for the agencies to be able to distribute the money. So although it's not implicitly written in the language, it certainly is in the intent to remove those barriers. So just so you know, it may not have the word that you're looking for in the bill, but certainly the intent is there and it's been discussed repeatedly. So thank you for the question.
You're done?
Just one more comment, Mr. Chair, if I may. It's good to see the state of Minnesota is catching up with the real world.
There you go. Good comment.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, and also I believe we have an answer to the clawback question as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So just so you know that in our process for awarding the grants, we've actually built in to the contract, similar to how we would with a financial, like with our financial aid awarding from OHE, we've built into the process a mechanism for reimbursement if the training isn't completed, or if someone decides to not go through with the program. So if someone's been awarded the grant, but then they decide not to go through with it, then that money never goes out the door and stays within the grant program, so it can be reawarded to someone else. So that we have built those mechanisms into our process.
Mm-hmm. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize I came in a little bit late if this has been covered. Just for clarifying question, I thought I heard one of the testifiers refer to this as students. And so just for my own sake, my understanding of the program is that this is largely for existing employers to kind of re-up their skills. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Well, thank you, Representative Lean. And so the biggest reason that we're bringing this forward really is so that we are capturing the high school student or a high school equivalent and new employees, so looking at new hires. And so a lot of this revamping, I'd say a good a third or more, is to get at that issue, because we did see that who we were serving essentially was incumbent workers, and we really wanted to have a focus even greater on new hires, which is what industry needs. And so I thank you for that question, and I'd say at least a third of the language here is to get to that issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, Representative O'Neill,
you got any? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple other testifiers just from the Technical College. Thank you so much. Because you can hear how it actually happens, feet on the ground. So we've got a couple of our instructors that are coming.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
My name is Jeff Thorstad.
My name is Brad Thorpe.
We're both instructors at Hempen Tech College in the automation robotics area. And right now we're seeing a very high growth in our area, which includes automation, robotics, and mechatronics. Currently, DEET estimates that there will be 300 new job openings through the year 2023 in our area, and those numbers do not account for the retirements, which will be coming soon. Currently, in our program, we graduate between 30 and 40 students per year. Statewide, similar programs. Best case scenario, as far as I can estimate, we are graduating about 180 students per year statewide. as we're going through and we're looking at where our students end up, one of the big issues for our employers has been trying to get students. Our students, when they graduate, will have multiple job offers. 3 to 5 companies offer them jobs at wages between $20 and $35 per hour. One of the big difficulties for a company has been how to differentiate them from other companies so they actually get their employees. And through this work, one thing that companies are able to do is hire young students fresh out of high school, pay for their education, and then the students are committed to that company when they graduate, and the company better serves their workforce. Currently, our program at Hennepin Technical College in total has approximately 118 students. Some are degree completing, some are just taking individual courses. But with that, currently we have between 10 and 15 students who are in the program through the Pipeline Project, which is a fairly significant number. We are working with 3 to 5 companies on this process to further educate their students. Average age currently of our standard student is the age of 30. The pipeline students are younger. I don't have the specific numbers based on my estimate of looking at the students. Average age seems to be, between 25 and 29 years of age.
So I was involved with Brad Thorpe. And I'm with the Automation Robotics Engineering Technology Program. I'm one of the instructors there. And last summer I started a discussion about the pipeline project and bringing companies together with secondary institutions like ours. And so I was involved on the ground level and at the very beginning, getting involved with the companies, getting their employees into the program and supporting that process. So a couple of the hiccups that we ran into was basically getting all of those parties talking to each other, the employees, the employer, and then the secondary school. Having that conversation's difficult to do with work schedules and keeping everybody, or everybody's already busy enough. So a lot of emails and then some face-to-face meetings were needed to make that happen. The enrollment timing, like we heard before, it was really tight. And then once we got the companies on board, waiting to get the approval of the pipeline grant and then registration for those students, they didn't overlap very nicely. And we ended up having some issues with students being dropped out of the program, and then we worked with financial aid to get them back on board. So we didn't lose any students in the process, but it did create quite a bit of extra work. We know going forward the timelines look a lot better now, and we're definitely having a large increase from those that are currently involved, those about 10 to 12 students that are currently involved in the 3 to 5 companies. They're all coming back with more students. And so an example is one company has gone from, I think, about 8 students involved up to, right now, we just met with them this last week, to about 15. So they're looking at over doubling the amount of students that are involved in the program. We also had some issues with what qualifies, and we heard that as well. Do books qualify? Do tools qualify? What can be included in that? And then the billing at the college level was a little difficult to work out. Myself and Jeff are not usually involved with figuring out where these students are getting their funding from and what qualifies, and so that was a challenge for us, but we've got a lot clearer picture now and can definitely get that information out a lot easier in a timely manner this time around. So those are a couple of the things that we had issues with, and I think they're all manageable issues now, and particularly that timeline. We had to align our curriculum to the goals that were set. So it was nice graphical there, right? And so they were really quality goals established by the industry experts that you were talking about earlier, and our classes aligned very nicely to those. The question that I would ask is, the program intending on fully certifying through a diploma or a AES degree the students? If so, the general education courses that are required by the degrees and the diplomas weren't really addressed in that. They were just the technical side. And again, that goes back to what can qualify for it. Can we do general education courses and pay for those as well? I think everybody would agree that would be the end goal, to get fully students that have a diploma or AAS and leaving fully qualified. So that would be something to look at going forward. And then flexibility for potentially adding extra students if companies are already involved and has the funding in place. Can they bring on more students? Because that's what happens once it gets started, it kind of snowballs. And is that able to happen? I know the companies that we have involved, like I said, doubled, and they're expecting more interest once those students start up in the fall. So seeing this, I know the funding is available for 1 to 2 extra years. The companies that are going to be involved are really going to be supportive of it, and I know they'd want to see this continue beyond those years if possible. So.
Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either of the testifiers, well, I've got a series of questions. You spoke to 8 students in last year, and one employer sent 8, and then they came back the next year and sent 15. Are those new employees or just advanced training for current employees?
Demographics from the company, I'm not completely sure on that. To be truthful, they are younger students who do not have the full college education from technical school, and in order to progress through the company, need the higher skill set. Without actually seeing the demographic of the students, I'm not able to fully answer that question.
One of the 8 current students is a student that was in our program that got hired by that company, and they were able to then support the continuation of that student's education. So that's a perfect example where they're a brand new student in our program, they got hired by the company, and then they were able to fund their second year education through that. So I'd say overall they're younger employees. Does that address your question?
Well, it does, but it poses another question, because my understanding of this was they need, in order to partake in the program, they need to be employed by the employer. So either they are new hires or they are current employees going back for extended training. And it doesn't seem that you have an answer for that one.
So to answer that directly, they are new employees. They were all currently employed at the company.
Okay.
They were not re-upping or increasing beyond, they didn't have any formal education prior to that.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
So if I could just address that really quickly. So there was, they found that a lot of, if you look at statistically, out of the 125 folks that came through the system, there was a heavier focus on incumbent, and really we were hoping that there was going to be a heavier focus on new hire. And so the language that we have in front of us is to kind of retool it. So we really are focusing on some of the new hires that are coming in. And I could probably have one of the, either Jessica or Nicole, come up again and give you the exact percentages of incumbent versus new hire. I don't have those in front of me, but I guess my point is that the new legislation is retooling so that we can encourage more new hires, because that's what the industry needs.
Yeah, I don't need them to come back up. I have another question, and now I'm a bit confused. So, and I did step out to get lunch, which happens to be a cup of coffee today. So for the author of the bill, how many people have been involved in this program? How many students has this program touched or moved through the through their process?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's 125.
So it's dealt with 125 people at this particular point. Okay. And do you have a geographical breakdown of whether the 11 county metro area versus the 76 greater Minnesota breakdown?
We do. Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes. So there's a handout that shows you that it's essentially a 50-50 split between the two. And I would note, too, that this legislation also has a lesser focus, not no focus, but just a lesser focus on greater versus metro and a higher focus on some the high school and GED equivalent folks, because we really want those that haven't had substantial training to come into the whole system and get trained. So there is, again, a little bit of change in the legislation. Not that there is no focus on greater Minnesota versus metro, but it's taken a second seat in a sense. And the reason is because it was very hard to do a whole grid system to say, well, you know, percentage here, percentage there, and it just got to be very cumbersome in a brand new launch of a program to accomplish that. But it's still contained within the language, but it's the first focus is the new higher high school or GED equivalent.
And it's nice to see another legislator taking the metro side, you know, than the chair. I'll find out some of the other stuff. I had some other questions, but I can certainly get those offline. So thank you.
Well, in deference to the next bill, we would love to have Representative O'Neill renew her motion, and the testifiers and Representative O'Neill will answer any questions that you have on this bill later. To pass this bill on and send it to Jobs and Energy Finance Committee.
So moved. Yes, so okay. I renew my motion that House File 2798 be passed and referred to the Jobs Energy Committee, where Representative Mahoney and I can have further discussions.
Thank you. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Passes. On your way to Jobs. Thank you very much to the testifiers. Representative Keel. Would love to move her House File 2872 to pass and go to Jobs. I'll be right outside.
That would be much appreciated.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to bring forth this bill, House File 2872, to the Greater Minnesota Regional Workforce and Community. This is a Greater Minnesota Regional Workforce and Community Development Pilot Program. That's quite a mouthful, isn't it? Have to work that around so we have a better acronym. The first thing you'll notice about this bill is it's got a big name, and hopefully packing a lot of promise for Greater Minnesota into this project. This bill is to attempt to identify, coordinate, and support the local communities around Greater Minnesota that are coming together in a market to assets of the region, to potential new residents and workers. Our keynote testimony will come from a person who has done extensive research into population movement in Greater Minnesota and across the nation. He will challenge the notion that the shade is slowly being drawn down on Greater Minnesota. Not so. He will provide proof that there is growth in key demographics area of the 20 to 49 year olds who are seeking a simpler lifestyle and a sense of community that only can be found outside the hectic place of metro areas. This best recent example occurred just last week in my own district. There was a young man, if you heard about it, named Christopher Ingraham, I can't even pronounce that name, from the Washington Post. He was a reporter that had decided that Red Lake County, one of my counties in my district, was the worst county in the United States. Well, the people in Red Lake County begged to disagree and said, that's not true. And so they invited Mr. Ingraham up to Red Lake County to show them what they had to offer. Red Lake County does not have a stoplight anywhere in the
whole county. So it's a small county. So they showed him a great time and some real family and community, and by golly, I don't know if you've noticed the news, but he has decided to keep his job at the Washington Post but relocate to Red Lake Falls, Minnesota. So he is intending to raise his family there. So just one of the little stories. This, of course, got a lot of press. So, but there are a lot of stories, I believe, that are happening like that around the area. So today with me, I have Dan Larson from the Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus, and he'll describe the bill. And then I'm also very pleased to have Ben Winchester, who is a speaker in great demand and an author of numerous publications related to the migration of people. In a key demographic I spoke of before, the demographic of my future constituent, Mr. Ingram, is in the 30 to 49 year olds looking for a slower pace and a fuller life that can be found in greater Minnesota. Mr. Winchester is a rural sociologist and a senior fellow with the Extension Center for Community Vitality. So with that, I will have Mr. Larson explain the bill.
Welcome to our committee, Mr. Larson. Give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, can you all see me over the desk here? I got the short one.
I got the little kid's chair. I was sitting in it over there, too.
Okay. Pleasure to be here, Mr. Chair and members. Dan Larson, Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus, 28 counties in greater Minnesota, the only organization that advocates specifically for rural county concerns. Very excited to be here today because we are very excited about this bill. At its core, the bill will identify, coordinate, and support the numerous energetic economic development opportunities emerging throughout greater Minnesota that are largely volunteer and universally underfunded. It taps into the exciting but largely counterintuitive trend that Mr. Winchester is going to talk about, and will expand upon what Representative Keel just mentioned, a key demographic of 30 to 49-year-old migrations to greater Minnesota. And like Mr. Ingram, the reporter from the Post, who will, like Mr. Ingram, who again is moving from Washington to Red Lake, the city, to Red Lake County, also like Mr. Ingram, will work from a remote location. That's very key now because technology is allowing this trend. So in deference and watching the time, what I'd really like to do is limit what my comments will be and save questions for later. But Mr. Chair and members, the Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus has been instrumental in building this bill, moving this bill forward, and Mr. Winchester has been instrumental from day one in helping us to identify what the key issues should be, that the key concepts should be included in the bill. So without any further delay, unless there's questions, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Winchester.
Mr. Winchester, please give your name for the record, and we're looking forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ben Winchester. I am very pleased to be here today and to share some very good news coming out of rural Minnesota. In fact, this good news is so good that you haven't heard about it for over 30 or 40 years. I do a lot of research under the umbrella of what's called rewriting the rural narrative. And my premise here is that the narrative we're using to describe what's going on in our rural communities is straight out of 1950. We haven't done a lot to really understand some of these trends that have been going on ever since. Very thankful here today that we've got a bill that will help support some of the efforts that I've seen undergo across rural communities in Minnesota and rural areas in general across the country. I've presented at least a dozen times in every one of your districts, I can promise you that, to your Lions Clubs, your Kiwanis Clubs, your Chambers, your Initiative Foundations, your RDCs. I know all those groups well. I know the kind of work they do and the type of vitality that they like to promote across our rural communities. The program that we envision here, I guess, is really step one. It's trying to identify, you know, what are some first steps we could take to help our rural communities better market themselves, and why does that matter? So as I work for University of Minnesota Extension, so I'd be remiss if I didn't do a little bit of a history lesson. We have had a number of structural changes that have occurred across our rural communities for over the past 100 years. That starts with the mechanization of agriculture in the early 1900s that reduced the number of farm workers by 50 to 75% in any given area. We've also witnessed some what I would call restructurings on Main Street, where we lose, you know, we used to have multiple grocery stores, multiple gas stations, you name it. And these changes are paramount, and they help to define what our community is. And even today, we've got many people living in our rural communities that remember how life used to be 40 years ago, when we used to have filled main streets, and we didn't used to have consolidated schools, and all these efforts that have really undertaken in our small towns that have challenged our identities. You see boarded up buildings at different times. You see school districts challenging themselves. And even today, communities are struggling with their identity when we talk about post offices closing. So all of these things, in my view, work from a deficit approach of describing our rural communities. But since 1970, the rural population in Minnesota and the U.S. in general has gone up by 11%. It has not gone down. The relative percentage of people living in rural Minnesota has gone down, but that's only because the urban growth rate is at 40%, the rural growth rate is at 11%, and where does that matter? Representation, right? We have a smaller number of representatives from rural areas, but the population still goes up. Even in the southwestern part of the state, we do see overall population losses, right? Our numbers outside of town and our sign go down. And we think that we're losers because we lose people. But when you look more closely at the actual demographics of who we're losing, it's the high school graduates. They drive population declines all across southwestern Minnesota and the western border counties. In fact, when you look at the data between population change and housing, there are plenty of places that experience overall population decline, but the housing remains stable or goes up. How does that happen? It's because your population losses are driven by 18-year-olds graduating, and those 18-year-olds do not own homes because they're leaving their parents' home. So the story of population change across rural Minnesota is very nuanced. And so this led to the first studies I did in 2002. I was the first employee at the Center for Small Towns at the Morris campus where I did my undergraduate work in math and stats. And I started to run across these numbers all the time. We had 30 to 50-year-olds moving to every rural county in Minnesota in the 90s, save for two or three. This trend continued in the 2000s. And I thought, as a good researcher, I need to find out who's written about this before, right? And what do I find? I look in the literature, what do I find? Nothing. There's almost nothing to describe this trend of 30 to 50-year-olds moving in. In many cases, for example, Grant County, between 1990 and 2000, their population overall was flat. But they lost a large number of high school kids, but they brought in enough people aged 30 to 50 to make up for those population declines. That kept their population flat. If we did not have this demographic of 30 to 50-year-olds moving into our rural communities, your populations would be anywhere between 3 to 10% lower than they are today. The other piece of this is that this trend of 30 to 50-year-olds moving to rural areas and rural America in general has been happening since the 70s. This isn't even new. I wrote about it for the first time in 2002, and everybody said, oh, that's just the lakes, right? That's where we see overall population gains. So this tells the story of a very nuanced way of approaching community change, right? It's much more complex. So we did interviews, focus groups, surveys. This happens in the Panhandle of Nebraska, mind you, where I've got colleagues, and we did a number of studies to understand the motivations behind these people moving in. The top three reasons people gave why they moved to a rural community were slower pace of life, safety and security, and the low cost of housing. Moving for a job was not in the top five in Nebraska, and it was not in the top 10 in Minnesota. Obviously, people had to find a job, but they found a region first, and then they found a job in that region. These people were bringing their kids. 51% of the newcomers had kids. 67% of these newcomers had no previous contact with that rural community. So this wasn't just the kids that left town and went to the metro or went off to college moving back. A full two-thirds of your newcomers are true newcomers. They don't know, have familial ties. They don't know who the good electrician in town is. They don't know who to go to for a plumber or for childcare. The assets of rural Minnesota are buried in digital content right now, and this is part of what I support about this bill, is that we can't rely upon Google to not only provide the assets we've got, but to put them in an accurate location. We found first and foremost that many businesses were not using regional assets as part of their recruitment strategies. People moving into our rural communities are more than just warm bodies there to work. They are people looking to invest themselves in their lives, their children's lives, the school systems. They want to pay property taxes. They were homeowners overwhelmingly. They spent more money on volunteerism, more time leading their community groups. In fact, even in the southwestern part of the state where there's a 5% population decline, there's a 14% increase in the number of nonprofits. That doesn't tell me that social life is dying in rural communities. It's changing. Rural America and rural Minnesota has been changing right under our noses. But we're letting this deficit approach dominate every conversation we have about rural Minnesota, and this frustrates me. Now, I've given this presentation numerous times, and many communities come up to me and ask, well, what can we do? And I say, I don't know. We don't know the path forward. And so nominally, what I've seen at the local community level, Fairmont, City of Fairmont, for example, put $5,000 toward what they call this brain gain initiative. Because again, we've got this language around brain drain, right? Brain drain is all about the loss of your high school kids. All right, so we're losing high school kids on one hand, but on the other hand, we're gaining people aged 30 to 50. They're coming with earning power, with a career, with skills, with knowledge, with education, with income potential. I call this the brain gain. And if we continue to lament the loss of our high school kids and use that to describe the narrative of our small towns, we're doing a disservice to all those who have chosen to move back. So as we look forward to business recruitment, there are a couple key things on my radar right now when I look ahead over the next 30 years, and many of you know this. Number one, labor shortage. It's coming. It's, if not already started, right? In many of our rural communities, it's the exception, not the rule. Not the rule, but in many of our rural communities, we're starting to see a labor shortage. On the other hand, a new area of research I'm in, and there's a symposium on small towns this June in Morris to talk about the rural housing situation. In some of our communities, we have a rural housing shortage. But over the next 30 years, 70% of the homes in rural Minnesota will be on the market. Anywhere between 30 to 40% of your homes right now are owned by people over the age of 65. 40% of your homes are owned by baby boomers. Who is going to move in, who's going to move out, and who's going to move over? I would like to think we would be able to provide homes in our communities for those that want to move into a low-maintenance home or something that's single level, to move out of that single-family home and keep those retirement dollars, literally, in your community. They're called transfer payments. Keep those transfer payments in our communities and in our counties. Open up the home that senior was in for incoming 30 to 50-year-olds to move into. Again, it's moving in, moving out, and moving over. So the Initiative Foundations had a conference last June, and they talked about the rural choice. And they acknowledge that this trend was real, that there may be some things we can do about it. We don't know what we can do. So it's helped inform. I'm really at the point of informing people about this trend. We don't know the path forward, but we can't be afraid to try. So with that, we want to try something new here. And I want to reiterate the fact that people are moving to all of your small towns today for what you are and not what you were. Nobody remembers that when I moved to Hancock, I recently moved to St. Cloud 3.5 years ago, but we lived in Hancock for 13 years. Within 2 weeks after I moved into town, the grocery store closed. All of the people moving to Hancock today don't know anything about that grocery store that used to be there. They don't know anything about the school that used to be consolidated, or not consolidated in Starbuck or Glenwood. So I just want to reiterate, people are moving to your communities for what you are today and what you're going to be tomorrow. They don't remember where you've been. So let these people make their home in our small towns on their terms. So with that, we do have a number of efforts across the state that are fairly disparate. There's a regional recruitment group out of Appleton with the RDC there. It is, again, very much based on volunteer time. People are making these efforts to try to do activities, but with volunteer time, it's unreliable, and you don't get much depth in engagement. There's a group called Greater Minnesota Rising in the northwest part of the state. There's a group called the MN Bump in Big Stone County, and there's the Fairmont Brain Gain group activities that take place through the chamber in the city of Fairmont and the region down there. And what I like about this when Dan first approached me is that this is regional. No town is a one-stop shop anymore. This isn't the horse and buggy time of Little House on the Prairie. This is a time when we are deeply interconnected and transportation systems have changed everything of how our towns are connected to one another and how they're connected to the metro areas as well. So with that, I just want to encourage your support for this effort that I believe has a groundswell of interest based on the presentations I've given across the state, but just really haven't had access to the resources to do work in this area. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your time here today.
Thank you. Any questions from the members? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Sundin.
Maybe a comment or two. First, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank Representative Keel for bringing this up. Last year you had a bill for rural Minnesota, and it was maybe too good of a bill, what I understand. Yep. But this is a good initiative, I guess. But I guess I would ask Mr. Winchester if this bill would make a whole lot more sense if we added 12 words to the very end of it. And those 12 words would be contingent on a $100 million investment in broadband improvements in rural Minnesota. Would that help this bill become a reality and give it some real traction if broadband expansion became a reality in the state of Minnesota? Yes or no?
In my opinion, I don't do research on the topic, but I can tell you that I lived in Hancock, Minnesota, a town of 770 people, for a number of years, and my broadband speed was faster there than it is at my home in St. Cloud. And that is because of the investment that the state has made with Federated Telephone and with the broadband expansion. And this is not just to every small town, but to every rural homestead. And when we look at the numbers, we start to see, for example, Occoquan County now has a good 11% of the workforce works from home. I don't think they could have done that before. So in a way, I'm very supportive of any effort. But again, I would expand upon the fact that I think we've shown it has worked in many ways, that you can't just paint a broad stroke about rural broadband is lacking when we have some real shining examples, in my opinion, of broadband that's worked.
Thank you.
We'll talk about that Thursday.
I think you pointed out that they are isolated pockets.
That's right.
Let's take care of the whole state at some point as well. Thank you for the bill.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I echo Representative Sundin's comments that this is kind of some new thinking, but certainly leading to some hopefully positive results. I just have a couple questions. First of all, is this limited to just online efforts or web-based efforts, or maybe a better way to ask it is if communities have other methods of promoting their communities, trying to get new workers there, new businesses there, are they also eligible, besides online efforts, web-based efforts, are they also eligible for this funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the issue is geared towards digital. It's geared towards marketing from a digital perspective. So that's, if you look at the criteria, I think the answer to that is primarily.
Representative Lee?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Marketing efforts, okay, that makes sense. And my second question is, it looks like at least just from how I'm reading this, a criteria is that the community has already done some promoting or done some outreach efforts. I just see here line 2.24 demonstrate that outreach efforts have attracted new workers to the community. So it looks like you want to jump in. So, yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, the idea, the concept here is to identify in a one-year pilot project initiatives that are already created, already up and operating on a regional basis, that are marketing digitally to identify them, coordinate them, and give them some support and structure. So maybe to go back to your previous question on the marketing, from a digital perspective, absolutely.
You don't remember the meetings.
This is geared towards somebody in the metro area or a different state who might be tired of the rat race, who might be looking at Greater Minnesota and saying, I know somebody out there and they're having a great time. They can hunt and fish. They can get done with work and be in their boat in 5 minutes. So he Googles jobs in Greater Minnesota, and Red Wing Shoe comes up, or Mississippi Welding or Marvin Windows. This is a whole nother concept. This is based, once we, there's a bigger plan for this. Once we get this up and operating, we want something at the state level. We're the only state among the five states in Nebraska that doesn't have a statewide program, a platform that would catch that Google, Greater Minnesota Jobs, and say, welcome, you're in the right place. Images of Greater Minnesota. You're not alone. Other people are doing it. There's opportunity here for you. Where do you want to go? Hit Southeast. You'll have an interactive map. Punch the Southeast. Instead of, again, Red Wing Shoe coming up or Mississippi Welding, images of the bluffs, trails, parks, the Mississippi River. Okay, so now I'm interested. The assets that an individual would consider when moving his family to a location. Now, you get a little deeper, and in the mapping that that Mr. Winchester referenced, because right now there's no guarantee if you map something in Greater Minnesota, you're going to hit the mark on a Google map. So we want, part of this is, when you get down into it, we want high school kids to go talk to their businesses and help with the mapping component of this, and this is the local leadership level, this training level. So you've got local high school students, if we work it right, talking to their businesses, getting to know each other better, and mapping the locations. Everybody works. And hopefully the high school kids can get some STEM credit out of it. So now I'm that same guy and I'm Googling. Now I'm interested. But I've got a 6'10 sophomore who can dribble. And I have bursitis in my hip. So where are the high schools that play good basketball and who can take care of my hip? Well, you've already mapped it out. So you're going to get high schools that can talk about five state titles and we send kids to Duke and here's what we can do for your hip. Right now there's nothing like this. And that's when we flush this out, that's where we want to go. Representatives, members, the Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus is excited about this bill. We're the group, if you know and understand the Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail System, some of you went through those battles, but this is the group that started what became now the Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail Commission. Asset-based marketing. Money to small, largely volunteer, universally underfunded park groups that really needed structure and funding. Well, 7 years later, we've got money in a lot of the districts represented around this table and new projects. And in fact, a brand new state-of-the-art regional park and trail system in Greater Minnesota that never existed before. 10 years worth of funding for every year that they used to, every year they, now they currently get 10 years of funding. So a plan and hope to help tap into the trend that Mr. Winchester talks about.
Mr. Larson, due to the time, I think Representative Keel would like to renew her motion to have House File 2872 passed and be referred to Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would.
Okay, all in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. And before we adjourn, Representative Moran has a guest that's going to be here probably quite a bit. I think she'd like to introduce her. Okay. Welcome to our committee, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have a young lady, Leona Henderson.
Come on down.
Leona Henderson is a young lady who is a student from Minnesota Internship Charter School in St. Paul. And she will shadow me over the next 5 weeks, and I'm really, really excited to have her here. So let's recognize Leona.
We're glad you're here.
Thank you.
And with that, we will adjourn. We're looking forward to broadband next Thursday.